On this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we discuss Jose Ramirez, what a player he is, and the legacy he has built and will continue to build with the Cleveland Guardians signing another extension that will take him through the end of his playing career. We talk about Mackenzie Gore being traded to the Rangers, Harrison Bader signed with the Giants, and we review MLB Network's top 100 players list. Who's too high? Who's too low? Who's not even on it? All that and more on this episode of Baseball Barbacast.
Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that thinks the Jose Ramirez statue should just be an actual fire hydrant. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. I think it'd be easier that way.
One of the most unique builds in baseball history will one day be headed to Cooperstown as a Cleveland Guardian. There was no doubt about that before this weekend's news. But now Mr. Ramirez will ascend into a very, very, very inner circle of Cleveland greats. That is, of course, some of the biggest news we will talk about from this weekend, plus a big trade. Mackenzie Gore is headed to Texas, but let's begin with Mr. Ramirez. Let's do it. It's the opener.
He's built like a fist, a bulldog, the aforementioned fire hydrant. There really is only one Jose Ramirez. And his career in our current world of sports is, frankly, something of an outlier. An outlier that feels really good to witness. And the news this week is that Mr. Ramirez and the Cleveland Guardians, the only employer he has ever known, they have agreed to a new extension worth $175 million. It will add 7 years onto his deal. It will keep him in Cleveland until he is 40 years old. And I mean, this is great. Like, this is awesome. He is one of the best players in the world. And for him to commit to Cleveland for his entire life, Jordan is a Northeast Ohio resident. Were there parades this morning?
Too much snow, so not quite. But this is, although it is worth noting that Jose Ramirez was in Cleveland to hammer out these negotiations with the front office and ownership last week as it was like negative 20 degrees. And Jose was like, yes, this is where I want to be. This is where I want to stay. This is where my family is happiest. And that is a beautiful thing. So there are certainly some big picture Jose things that we can talk about. But let's make sure we're clear about the details here. It's really adding only 4 years to a extension that he was already on. And this is part of why this news kind of caught some people by surprise, because Jose Ramirez's original contract, which was actually the second extension that he had signed since arriving in the big leagues, when Jose kind of became an everyday player in 2016 for the team that won the pennant, that was like kind of came out of nowhere. And before the 2017 season, they signed him to his first extension, which was like 5 years, $26 million, with team options for 2022 and 2023. So that was the first team-friendly deal that, you know, we've seen styles of contracts signed early in their career. But for a player who was not considered a top prospect at the time, it was like, okay, you want to lock in this guy's salary during his pre-arb and arb years, and maybe you have a really cheap team option if he turns into something. That is exactly what happened. Now, as they approach the end of that first contract, which is the 2022 season, which really would have been that first of those team options worth like $11 million. At this point, Jose Ramirez has been an MVP finalist multiple times. He's clearly one of the best players in baseball. And so they started discussing restructuring their contract and coming up with a larger extension. But because he was so good and so cheap, and because free agency was looming 2 years from then, this is not an easy thing to hammer out between one of the best players in baseball and one of the cheapest teams in the sport. And yet, because even then Jose Ramirez wanted to be in Cleveland, they figured it out. They made it work, and they signed the first contract, which was, I believe, 7 years and I think $141 million guaranteed, which was still way below market for how good of a player he was, but was enough of a commitment for Jose to say, yes, let's do it. We will commit long term. He was going to be traded to either Toronto or San Diego. That is a fact. They had trades ready before opening day of 2022, but they figured it out. They signed that deal, at which point he then becomes almost the poster child of, like, he's underpaid. One of the best players of baseball. He's doing this organization a favor. I can't believe that Jose Ramirez is only making $20 million. So, you know, blah, 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 blah. And he just stays elite. He's just still putting up 5 WAR, 6 WAR every season. And so in the 4 years since he signs that first extension, he's just one of the best players of baseball. And you kind of assumed that as this end of this extension would be approaching, that he would maybe be declining. And so it would kind of just age off gracefully. And then by this point, he would maybe not be as good and he wouldn't be quite as underpaid and so on. That has not happened. And so now a different conversation around Ramirez has happened in Cleveland, which is like, wait a minute, there's this window where, oh my God, now his free agency is coming in 3 years. We don't know how much longer he's going to be this good. They needed to, both the organization and Ramirez felt like they needed to have even more clarity about whether this was definitely going to be a lifetime partnership. And they went out of their way with 3 years left on their deal to guarantee him another 4 through his age 39 season, which will essentially guarantee he will be a Guardian for life and he will be the greatest player in franchise history in all likelihood.
Do you want to talk about just how good Jose Ramirez is, or do you want to talk about the Guardians franchise and where they're at?
Let's first explain why I can very confidently say what I just said, which is that he's going to be the greatest player in franchise history. He has spent, even me living in this area for the last couple of years, every few weeks in the press box, they're like, oh, Ramirez just set this franchise record. Oh, he climbed this leaderboard. It's whether it's doubles, total bases, stolen bases, hits. It's just a common recurrence. And that is going to continue happening all the way through the end of this contract. He's going to end up at or near the top of basically every offensive leaderboard. But when you look at his career, when you watch Jose Ramirez, when you look at the Baseball Reference page, what stands out to you from a statistical standpoint? Why can I so easily say that he is going to be the greatest player ever and has been one of the best players of his generation?
I mean, he doesn't miss time, right? That's a huge part of it. Plays every day. Mm-hmm. When you look at the games played since 2020, 152, 157, 156, 158, 158. Like, he's out there every day. And then for me, it's the steals and the homers. You know, we talked about Carlos Beltran when he got into the Hall of Fame last week, being one of the few players in the 400 home run, 300 stolen base club. The 300 club is very small. There are only 8 players. This season, unless he forgets the rules of the sport, Jose Ramirez is going to become the 9th member of that group. Is it 285 home runs? Is it 287 steals? I hope he gets there in the same day. That would be so on brand. That would be so freaking cool if he got to 300 for both, like, simultaneously. Oh, goes yard in the first, steals second in the third, like, beautiful. But he's just one of the most consistent offensive performers while providing very good defense at an important defensive position. It's really not that complicated. And what I find so interesting about him is, like, his game hasn't really changed. Like, what he does well has maintained the whole time. Where, like, Trout was, like, even as he was elite for this, like, 8-year span, Trout was, like, adding new skills and getting worse at other things and, like, getting to the value in these different ways. Whereas Ramirez, it's like, I'm going to hit 284 and I'm going to clock 29 home runs and I'm going to, you know, steal 28 bases and when the season's over, I'll finish 4th in MVP. That's just what he does.
Yes, I think you hit on most of the main points. I think a couple of the things that we have to point out, the fact that he became this to begin with is astonishing. I think of player he was in the minors, he had, I believe it was 13 career home runs in 335 in the minor league games. In the minors. He's now, you know, approaching 300 in the majors. And, you know, hit 39 a couple times. The steals have gone up. He has embraced the new rules and will happily, he's like, oh, it's getting even easier for me to steal. Great. Love that. And I want to get back to the power speed in a second. But because of his size, because of his modest signing bonus, signing for $50,000 out of the DR as a teenager, because he wasn't slugging in the minors and because he was kind of bouncing around positions, he just got that utility label. He was really just going to be a pinch runner. He was going to be a defensive specialist. He was going to kind of move around and be a really useful player. And he just decided, no, I'm going to be so much better than that. I'm going to be one of the best players in the sport. And I think the really most important element of that that has not been mentioned yet is that the dude doesn't strike out. And for him to never strike out 100 times in a season, this is what it looks like. And we've talked about this with Mookie and Altuve, some of the smaller guys too, to be able to have elite bat-to-ball skills and turn that into power because of how good of a hitter you are, not because of how strong you are. That is what makes him special. And for him to figure that out, you know, pretty early on in his career, like, oh, wait a minute, I'm such a good hitter. I and especially as a switch hitter, I can hit for power because I know exactly what pitches I'm swinging for. I'm, you know, targeting. And also I have such good hand-eye that I'm not striking out. So I'm not going to be, if I am putting on my A swing, I'm not suddenly striking out 150 times. That's really what makes him so ridiculously special. And last thing I'll say about the power speed element is, yeah, he's going to get to 300 this year. I hope I'm in the building when that happens, whether it happens on the same day or not. I mean, could he get to 400? Like, that's in play with how well he's been playing. I'm not saying it's a certainty, but that is a club of one. That is one player, and it is Barry Bonds. And with how Jose's playing, I don't, again, with the aging, he's just going to fall off at some point. We don't know when. He just had one of his best seasons. You know, he's going to be 33 this year. I think 400 is totally plausible. And that on in its own is why we're really talking about one of the best players of, you know, this generation. And sure, you can say he's clearly will benefit from the fact that the rules have made it easier to steal bases in the last couple of years. But it's not like he hadn't proven himself as a base stealer before then. So I don't think people would look at that as any sort of, you know, illegitimate achievement. So that's really what I'm going to be eyeing over these next 7 years where, lucky me, let's zoom farther out. I get to now watch this guy just, you know, not right off into the sunset because he's still elite, but however this goes, he's going to be around. And that is an amazing thing. I remember talking about when I was living closer to the Reds, being there at the very beginning of Elly De La Cruz, and he has so much to prove to become anything close to what Jose Ramirez was. But thinking about Elly and the career and that he could potentially have and knowing that I was there for his debut and all those things is so cool. Now to think about that just on the back end for a player like Ramirez to kind of watch however this unfolds and know that he's still elite is really exciting. And I just can't wait to see where it goes from here because he's one of one.
So to do it very simply, if you just look at Baseball Reference wins above replacement in the 21st century for position players, right? He is 20th on that list. And he's still cooking. Just had his age 32 season. He is one of the best players of the 21st century. Full stop. Jordan, I'm going to read some names that are ahead of him on this list. Okay? Of these names, let's see if we can agree who is definitively better than Jose Ramirez. Right? Like, no blink. Do not stop and collect $200. Here we go. Ready?
Mm-hmm.
Albert Pujols.
Yeah.
Okay. I think, yeah. Albert Pujols, Alex Rodriguez, Adrian Beltre, Mike Trout, Mookie Betts is the top five in B-War. I think all five of those players are better than Jose Ramirez or have had better careers than Jose Ramirez. Okay. Yep. Robinson Cano.
I don't know how to talk about Cano. I honestly
Me
don't.
Me neither. So let's not. Miguel Cabrera, better than Jose Ramirez right
better.
Now. And then you're getting in to like Carlos Beltran, Chase Utley, where it's like Beltran just got into the hall. He has 400 homers, 300 steals. Like there's a chance that Ramirez could catch Beltran. I think there's definitely a chance he could catch Utley. Then you have these first basemen, Freddie Freeman, Paul Goldschmidt, Joey Votto. I would say that if the world ended tomorrow, I would take that trio over him. But you could totally see him catching Goldschmidt and Votto. Freeman, obviously, kind of still cooking at a high level, harder to track down.
Yeah, I mean, if we're just talking, can he catch these guys in war? I mean, he's going to catch most of these guys. It's more about just how we're going to consider, you know, the totality of the career, really what he's already achieved. And this is what I keep reiterating. The dude's not done. He just had one of his best seasons. And I have no way to project how much longer he's going to be putting up 4 or 5 war. Because if he's got a few more of those in him, he's going to pass all these guys easily.
So in my mind, the guys on this list that are better than him, players who are better in the 21st century than him: Pujols, Rodriguez, Beltre, Trout, Betts, Miggy, Judge, Ichiro, Barry Bonds, Chipper Jones. I think there's a Machado argument. I think there is a Freddie Freeman argument. And I think there is some Robinson Cano argument that I don't feel like making. That puts him in like the 10 to 15 range of best players of the century. Right? That is rare air. That is a special, special, special thing that we're getting to witness. And if you look at this list too, it's like, how many of these dudes played for one team? Right?
Trout. Okay, so let's talk about that. Let's talk about that.
Votto. Mm-hmm. Thank God he didn't get up.
Almost
with the Blue
didn't.
Jays.
Yeah, Votto was a real close, really almost tainted that beautiful BRF page.
Trout, Votto, Judge, Chipper.
Mm-hmm.
That's it.
Short list. And I think too, this is really, as I'm writing about Jose this week, just grappling with that. The only active players who have been with their team longer are Trout, Jose Altuve, and Sal Perez. All three of those guys debuted in 2011. Ramirez debuted in 2013. If Jose Ramirez completes this contract, which takes him through 2032, he turns 40 in September of 2032. If he plays all the way through the end of that contract and appears in all those seasons, that will be 20 seasons with the Cleveland Guardians. 20 seasons with one team has only happened 19 times in Major League Baseball history. And because of the contract length, even though Perez, Altuve, and Trout are ahead of Ramirez, those guys might not get to 20 because of where they're at and where their contracts are and how old they are and whatever. Whereas right now, Ramirez is now under contract with the opportunity to get to 20 years with one team, which, as I just mentioned, has only happened, I believe, 19 times ever. This century, it's only happened with Jeter and Craig Biggio. And because I think Chipper Jones was only 19. Yeah, Chipper Jones was only 19 seasons. Now, that's a little messed up because of the strike. So his is a little screwed
up. Ripken.
And he was really young at that point. The point is, this is really what we're talking about. Forget, okay, where does he rank in war among his peers? 100 plus years of baseball history. This is so rare, and especially now, right? This is where it really all comes back in. Coming off the just how we've been talking about free agency this winter and just how this sport works and functions, it is so ridiculously rare for this kind of loyalty and this kind of stars aligning for this to happen, both in terms of the individual, in terms of the franchise. And as we turn this to Cleveland, which is really the thing I also wanted to make sure we talked about here, the Guardians have benefited outrageously from Jose being willing to, of course, play on this contract and then now extend and continue to stay here, because he has earned whatever he wanted. If he said, get me out of here at certain points, I imagine they probably would have had to explore that. And they were already exploring it anyway because of just the nature of what it means to be a small market team and make tough decisions, as we just had conversations about with the Brewers and so on and so forth. And those decisions are only becoming more difficult as what the players are making is so high. And we could talk about all the reasons why that's maybe unfair and giving the teams too much credit and saying, just pay these guys. And I hear that too. And there's some truth to that. But also in some cases, it's like, if Jose Ramirez was going to be on the open market, the Guardians were not going to afford him. That's what the fact. So because he wanted to stay there, though, they have had this advantage, which is to have a built-in 5-6 wins every year at an important position for 150 games. And to have him just everything he's the foundation on which the whole thing is built, and that they have decided to invest so little around him at many turns is obviously maddening. And this reinvestment in one of the few things that they know they have for sure is encouraging and good PR. And I will also point out that if you say that this specifically is also a team-friendly deal, I wouldn't go that far. I think this is kind of balancing out the original contract when you're guaranteeing him money in his late 30s that you clearly didn't need to. Either way, however you view it, I think when you look at how the Guardians have operated during Jose's tenure, there's certainly a level of disappointment. The fact they haven't made it back to the World Series since that 2016 team. Now we're coming up on 10 years for that. And you just hope that he has the opportunity to play in a team that looks more like a comprehensive contender than one that is clearly good enough to make the postseason more often than not. And that's a credit to everybody involved. Once we have gotten to the postseason, it still does not feel like Jose Ramirez has an awesome chance to win a World Series. And so I hope that changes at some point here while I am in the area. And when you talk about the ownership, it's, you know, the Dolan family since 2000. This could change. This is an important thing to watch with the Guardians, is that David Blitzer, who owns a few other sports teams, he's involved in the Sixers ownership and the Devils ownership, and I believe the Commanders ownership. He became a minority owner in 2022 when John Sherman left to become the full, you know, majority owner of the Royals. And he has an option to become the majority owner in 2028. Who knows how good Jose Ramirez is by then? Who knows how good Travis Bazan is by then? Who knows, right? Pushing it until then is tough to hear for Guardians fans that have been waiting, you know, decades. But it will be interesting if by then Guardians start to operate more like a mid-market instead of a small market, because right now they're in the bottom three of payroll, and that is really frustrating and deserves to be, have anger pointed in their direction. But if they start spending like, say, Kansas City has recently, you might see a much, much more successful operation. But then it might be too late. Who knows if Jose is still churning out six WAR seasons by then.
Now, since the Guardians lost the World Series in 2016, they have only won two playoff series. They've reached the playoffs six times. They won a wild card round in 22, and they won the DS in 24. But the fact of the matter is they have not built a World Series caliber roster around Jose Ramirez. That's a fact. I really, in my brain, keep comparing it to Trout and the Angels, because at least the Angels tried. And I'm saying that from an ownership perspective. Okay. Now, there are a million, you're laughing at me, and that's fair. There are a million problems with Angels ownership. Trust me, I'm not overlooking that. They spent the money. They did. They spent it poorly, unwisely, to a point that it kind of derailed the entire operation over there. But at least they were like, we have this special thing. Let's go sign Anthony Rendon, right? Let's add. What the Guardians have failed to do around Jose is just, and this is an ownership critique, is so embarrassing. It is one of the most infuriating things about our sport right now, because they have a once in a, not lifetime, but once in the history of a franchise type player willing to forego significant financial gain because he loves Cleveland, Ohio. And with all due respect to Cleveland, Ohio and Northeast Ohio, this is not a place that big name players are opting into to live and go and be, right? In free agency. That's a fact. And for Ramirez to say, this place makes me feel like home. I love this. I owe it to this organization, to this fan base. And for the organization, again, from the very top, to in turn say, thanks, Jose. We're going to pocket the difference, is just like mind-bogglingly embarrassing, because it's already a missed opportunity, right? It's already a missed opportunity, because the second that he starts declining, like, how does this work, what they have built, what they have created?
Yeah, they're really, really counting on this next wave to become
let me add one more thing. Like, for the front office, and we talk about this all the time, for the front office to assemble a competitive team year after year is unbelievably impressive. Like, I'm not criticizing Chris Antonetti or Mike Chernoff, who are the president of baseball operations and the GM. Like, the Guardians, for what they have been allowed to spend, have done superb things, right? Last year, their charge back to win the division was one of the most remarkable comebacks in the history of our sport, right? And they did that with an offense that, what, ranked 28th in the league?
Yep.
And so I'm not critiquing the front office or the coaching staff or the players or whatever. They are just operating below what they should be operating at, considering they have this singular character that's making the whole thing operational.
Yeah, and the Angels is a fascinating comparison and just speaks to just a lot of the state of baseball leadership. And it speaks to why, for all the discourse we have about the Dodgers and why they're awesome, yes, money is a huge part of it. And they have some once-in-a-lifetime situations there as well. You got to know what you're doing. You just got to know what you're doing. And the Angels are one extreme end of the spectrum of let's spend money and lose no matter what. And the Guardians are the other end of the spectrum of let's never spend money and let's win no matter what. The Guardians have, you know, the fourth most wins in baseball since Jose basically became an everyday player over the last 10 years. That is an astounding, I mean, it's amazing. Unbelievable.
That's amazing.
Considering they have been bottom by payroll the whole time. And we've had some more conversations about Milwaukee and so forth. But like we said, the fact that he's not languishing on a team that is nowhere near the postseason is, I'm sure, part of why he wants to stick around, because he does know I am probably going to get a chance to at least be in the postseason, and then let's see what happens. That has to be part of the calculus. If he was never making the postseason, he probably would not be as interested in staying, but I have to imagine.
I totally agree. But the idea that if you get in, anything can happen is true. But when you watch the Guardians try to hit,
That's
I don't understand how you can watch that lineup and be like, well, anything can happen if you get in. It's like, I don't know if anything can happen.
Yeah, we have a better sense of what's probably going to happen when you show up with 28th best OPS. So anyway, Jose is amazing. I'm lucky to watch him up close, and we will see as he marches towards 300-300 and 400-400. We will continue to talk about how awesome he is. All right. We take a break. When we return, Kenzie Gore, is he good? Let's talk about it.
And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Let's go around the league. When the offseason began, Mackenzie Gore's name was the subject to an avalanche of rumors. Seemingly every club in baseball that could use a starting pitcher, it was like, oh, maybe they could go get Mackenzie Gore. Well, guess what? He finally got traded. The Washington Nationals sending their best pitcher to the Texas Rangers for a quintet of prospects. Jordan, you will hold my hand and tell me about all of these young gentlemen in a second, but let's talk about Mackenzie Gore, who is good.
I think so. But it's so interesting when, and this whole offseason has had a lot of these, right? When you see an Edward Cabrera get traded, you see a Shane Boz get traded, and you see these enormous prospect hauls, and the way that the pitching enthusiasts are talking about these guys as if they are all about to become Cy Young Award winners. And then you go and look at what they've accomplished and you're like, okay, well, yeah, he's good. He's definitely good. And I think it's also an important distinction. And when I wrote about Mackenzie Gore last week at Yahoo, I kind of lumped them together, but it's not really fair. Dylan Cease gets thrown into this as well because his ERA was high. But Dylan Cease has had seasons where he has been a Cy Young contender. We have seen long stretches where Dylan Cease has been one of the best pitchers in baseball. That has happened. For most of these guys that have been traded, particularly the ones with multiple years of control, it is a much more flimsy track record of success. And while I understand that teams do not necessarily care about the results as much as the stuff and what can turn into better results, it is interesting for, in the case of Mackenzie Gore, who's honestly one of the more extreme versions of this, because unlike with Shane Baz and Edward Cabrera, whose workloads have been limited or interrupted several times over the last handful of years, Mackenzie Gore has pitched. He has spent the last 3 years in the Nationals rotation, and while he has had these like 6 week stretches where he looks unbelievable, on the whole, it has been pretty average. And yet, you can still understand why there would be some excitement about acquiring him, particularly for a team like Texas, who, we should mention, had the best team ERA in baseball in 2025, both overall and rotation ERA. And yet, when you looked at the names on the roster, you're still like, yeah, they could use a starter, and why they make sense to make a deal for Gore. But you watch Gore a little bit more up close. I know you've thought about this guy a good amount, and I feel like you've kind of fluctuated over the years about how excited you are about him. So where are you at with him now, and how optimistic you are that he can finally reach that level of like, oh, no, no, he's like a really, really good pitcher, which I don't feel like he's fully proven yet.
Yeah, I think he's a tick below that. I mean, he was an all-star last year. He had a really strong, good first half and then tailed off after that.
I mean,
like once I showed up, once I moved,
he was so bad.
He's pretty kind. Once I moved here, so like I moved here at the beginning of August in the Jake Mintz era. I mean, it was a 5.4 ERA. Yeah, it's not great.
Yeah.
But yeah, here's why I think Gore is different than Cabrera and Baz.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
There's a lot of developmental meat on the bone here. Okay, and here's what I mean by that. When Cabrera goes from a smart pitching team in Miami to a smart pitching team in Chicago, there'll be some tweaks and maybe they find something new. But I think we have a pretty good idea of like smart people have already tried to get the most out of Edward Cabrera, right? The same is particularly true with Shane Baz in Tampa Bay. Whereas for Gore, his experience on the Washington Nationals, like that group that was coaching him was definitively behind the times in terms of its modern capabilities and its understanding of modern pitching. And so for him to leave that environment, an environment that has been nothing but losing since he got there, to go to somewhere in Texas where they just showed that they can get outs, I think there is more distance between what Mackenzie Gore is and what he could be based upon the environment that he is leaving. Now, I would have felt the same about Mackenzie Gore 2026 if he had stayed with the Nationals in this new, more forward-thinking pitching group. And yes, I know Mackenzie Gore, like in the offseason, is working with smart pitching people, right? He has access to some of these modern things. And I think that is why I'm kind of interested in the Nationals' decision to make this move now, where you're, I would imagine, new president of baseball operations, Paul Taboni, is balancing two things here, right? I would imagine they believe that they can have, if they had kept Mackenzie Gore, that they can get more from him at the deadline this year with a strong first half. And I'm sure the Nats are confident in their ability to make him better than he's been. But what's the flip side of that, Jordan? He's a pitcher.
He is. Yeah. Which
he's a pitcher,
particularly in his case.
The whole thing can go belly up at any moment, right? And so it's like, just get what you can now. And I think that's what the Nationals went ahead and did here. Let's talk about it as a fit for the Rangers, who have had a very bizarre couple of years, this club. Since winning the World Series in 2023, it's just been so forgettable, frankly. And even last season, when they had the best pitching in the world, they were forgettable. What does Mackenzie Gore do for their chances as we head into 2026?
That's the thing. I think this makes them better when you look at the rotation and why they were able to compile such impressive numbers last year. It was Jacob DeGrom and Nathan Eovaldi being unbelievable. Jacob DeGrom staying healthy the whole year. Incredible. Their healthiest pitcher. What a hilarious turn of events. And then, like, Tyler Mahle had, like, a 1-8 in his sample of innings. And they had guys like Jacob Latz, who's going to be maybe competing for a spot, who were sneaky good. The bullpen, which has since been rebuilt with a bunch of new guys, was very solid. Jack Leiter, it was a decent rookie season. Some encouraging things, but that wasn't what was keeping the ERA down necessarily. The thing is, though, are we counting on DeGrom and Eovaldi to give you another 300 innings like that again, both from a workload and from a performance standpoint? I don't know. I mean, DeGrom just proved a lot last year, so I don't want to necessarily doubt him. He's one of the best pitchers that we've ever seen. Eovaldi has just dealt with so many injuries recently, it's hard to know, but he's been awesome when he's been on the mound. They clearly felt like they needed more certainty in the rotation, especially with how much they were rebuilding the bullpen. I think they probably wanted more upside and certainty in the rotation. Is Mackenzie Gore providing that? As we just said, that's debatable, but there's certainly upside. That said, the fate of the Rangers is going to be whether their offense can figure it out, because that is why
or they stays were, healthy
or stays like, healthy. But they just have so many hitters that, and the only change, they swapped out Semien for Brandon Nimmo, which is interesting. And you could say that is probably a step up offensively. They have a new catcher. They cut the cord with the Dolies. Yep, they cut the cord with the Dolies. That's true. And so, Wyatt Langford, we love Wyatt Langford. It's just a lot riding on, is Evan Carter something? Is Jock Peterson not the worst hitter in the sport? Is Josh Smith, you know, an actual regular average hitter, which would go a long way if he can give you that for 500 plate appearances? What is Jake Berger? That was an important acquisition for them, who's going to be getting a lot of time. And then Josh Young, who has generally been good when he's been healthy, but he has had a lot of injury issues as well. Seager was unbelievable last year when he was playing. He only played 100 games. So there's just still more questions on offense for this team right now, which, based on the names involved, maybe surprises you. But that's what failed them last year, and they have more to prove on that side of the ball. Whereas I think Gore, even if he's giving you something comparable to what he did with the Nats, and I would expect it to be maybe 5-10% better, if not a lot. The other sneaky thing with Texas is that I've seen some people talk about this. This is a contributor to their ERA. Globe Life Field has been the most pitcher-friendly ballpark in baseball for the last few years, or one of the two or three by park factors, which is really interesting. And I'd love to kind of learn more about why that has happened. More like, this was not always the case when they first opened it up, but now it has been extremely pitcher friendly. So that should help Gore's numbers as well. But at the very least, it is an encouraging move from the standpoint of, for whatever reason, whether it's TV money, whether it's ownership being cheap, they are not spending in the way that you would think that a team like Texas has in the not so distant past. When they're trying to keep this contention window open, this is at least an aggressive move that says, yes, no, we still have real intentions of competing in this division. And you have to give, you know, Chris Young in the front office credit for making a move like that. If they don't have money to spend, they have prospects clearly they can trade away.
Let's talk about the flip side, Washington Nationals. This is the first big trade of the Paul Toboni era. They sent Jose Ferrer to Seattle, but I would say this is kind of on a different level to that. What does the return here, Alejandro Rosario, Abimelech Ortiz, Yeremy Cabrera, Devin Fitzgerald, Gavin Fien, what does that return tell you about how the Washington Nationals are going to operate under Paul Toboni moving forward?
I think it's not an accident that four of these pieces are not close to the big leagues. I think that Ortiz will probably compete for first base DH at bats in 2026. And he finished really strong in AAA. So maybe he could be, you know, a useful platoon hitter maybe right away, which would be nice. But this is targeting as much upside that they generally would not be able to access. I think if they were going to trade Gore, they needed to feel like they were getting a really, really big return. Gavin Fien, who was a first-round pick last year, who was considered one of the best high school hitters in the class just a year ago, that's just upside that a year from now, if he progresses as expected, is just not a player you're really going to be able to trade for. Alejandro Rosario is an extreme case because he was tracking like an elite pitching prospect in 2024 and then got hurt and has been hurt since. He's apparently has not undergone Tommy John surgery in the almost 2 years since then, but is going to finally now. how exactly that went down, what exactly was going on behind the scenes, why he didn't get the surgery. It's still a little bit unclear. But the point is, and Toboni said this, this is just not a pitcher that was going to be available if he hadn't had this injury. You can say, well, then the injury must be pretty serious. How do you know he's going to be anywhere close to what he was before? You don't. But this is the kind of bet that the Nationals seem to be willing to make. I'm a little bit surprised that they were targeting mostly hitters here. Rosario's, of course, an arm with huge upside. And again, I can't, like, what he was doing in 24, you look at his numbers in 24, they're basically as good as any pitcher in the minor leagues of, you know, who threw 80 innings. So that is where he was headed. That's a long time ago now, and that's going to be a lot on his rehab and what that looks like in 2027. But Fien and Fitzgerald are both, you know, teenage hitters that just people are really excited about. And Cabrera is someone who was one of the youngest players in the Carolina League and had a really good season. Ortiz could help right away. So it seemed to be enough combination of long-term upside, some near-term, this guy can at least contribute, maybe is a bit of a sleeper in Ortiz after his really bad 2024. It's enough here that I can understand why they made the move. Clearly, they were not dead set on it. But when you have new front offices, you can imagine the inclination and the desire to start to acquire their kinds of players. And I think that is what we see here. But Fien now becomes a very, very important player in this organization. And I think if they didn't think they were going to contend with Gore in the next couple of years, which is a very fair assessment, then you got to think bigger picture. And that's what they did.
Before we move on, just because we're on DC now, I know this is a little off topic, but hopefully our friends at the Washington Post are able to continue to report on the Paul Toboni Washington Nationals. For those of you who did not see, there are multiple reports about the Post either slashing or cutting completely its sports page. And like, we don't need to, first of all, we have friends, good friends who work there, you know, and that would be an absolute shame. But for two kids who grew up in the DC area, like who fell in love with the sport and with sports by reading the paper every morning, I mean, inconceivable, right?
I can't. Yeah, I mean, yeah, I'm still a Washington Post subscriber because of the sports section.
Oh yeah,
this is an area of that is just. And even for us who are by no means traditional journalists and didn't necessarily grow up wanting to emulate that, part of, and honestly, if we're being real, part of that is because when we read the Washington Post, it's like, I can't do that. I can't do what these people are, how the quality of work that we've seen in the Washington Post, both growing up and even now as we've been in this business with people that we've had on the show, whether it's Chelsea James, Andrew Golden, Spencer Nussbaum, Jesse Docherty, like these are close friends and colleagues who we've seen work and create incredible stuff and cover, of course, sports, and we know there's a lot of other much more important things that are being covered right now. But it's inconceivable, and we just have to hope for the best that these extremely good journalists get to keep doing their job, because it'd be a shame for obviously for them and a huge shame for us too.
Now, one ball player who might actually subscribe to the Washington Post is Harrison Bader. Let's talk about Harrison Bader, who signed with the San Francisco Giants for 2 years and $20.5 million. I'm not like certain he subscribes to the Post. He's a New York guy, so I feel pretty certain he subscribes to the New York Times. That'd be great. How many baseball players have newspaper subscriptions?
There you go. There's a spring training topic for you right there. But
all right, let me write that down.
I guess I will. We'll see if I make it to Giants camp and talk to Harrison Bader this year. This is an interesting signing. The reality is the second tier of free agent hitters have generally just been lost in the shuffle. Part of that is because a couple of them took the QO, right? The Trent Grishams, Gleyber Torres. They were like, I ain't messing with this. And maybe that was smart. Because for the most part, the hitters that are not the super-duper stars at the top have kind of just lingered on the market. There are still a couple out there. Eugenio Suarez, Luis Suarez, right? Or Luis Arraez, excuse me. A couple other hitters near the bottom here. Harrison Bader is coming off essentially the best year of his career. First with the Twins, traded to the Phillies, got even better. Provides terrific outfield defense, always has. Just had the best really year of his career offensively. And that made it seem like, okay, he's definitely going to get a 2-year deal. He's not too old. right-handed hitting outfielders are very rare. Maybe Harrison Bader is going to cash in here. Instead, he gets a contract that I think a lot of teams, including the team he was just on, are like, well, wait a minute. Why didn't we just give Harrison Bader 2 years and $20.5 million? For the Giants, it's nice to see them, again, making some sort of move. I still think they should be have been more aggressive on some of the top-end free agents this winter. But this is a fills an obvious need, which was horrific outfield defense for the last year. He will fix that. Jung-Hoo Lee, it sounds like, is going to move to right field. Bader will handle center field. Am I feeling super awesome about Harrison Bader, the hitter in San Francisco? No, I'm really not. But I think they know they're at least getting some improved defense. And if he can hit at the bottom of the order, that they don't, again, the Giants, in theory, if they are functioning as intended, will not need Harrison Bader to be batting second, third, or fourth, or even fifth. So it's important that he brings the defense, and I think he can probably do that at the very least. But
and yeah. One of the biggest issues with the 2025 Giants was that Jung-Hoo Lee was borderline unplayable in center field. Like the defense out there was really, really bad. There were some bright spots about his season, no doubt. But when you're in that large of an outfield, it really helps to have someone who can go get it. And the worst version of Harrison Bader is still a valuable, helpful, everyday player because of what he provides with the glove. Now, him signing with the Giants has unleashed something of a firestorm in the city of Philadelphia, especially when you compare the two-year $20 million contract he got with the one-year $10 million contract Adolis Garcia got. You know, Bader spends the second half of last season in Philadelphia, plays through like an injury in the series against the Dodgers, and is like the best hitter in that series for the Phillies, right? Like we were having, oh, this whole series could have turned out differently if Bader had been healthy. You remember that? That was like a real thing. Now, I think it's really hard to square the Garcia deal with this, because it just feels like the Phillies brass kind of misread the market and misread the offseason. And Bader getting this low of a number makes you think that he could have fit into what the Phillies were trying to accomplish, particularly after having not gotten Bo Bichette, right? Where it's like there presumably is a little bit of wiggle room in there, and I would rather have Bader for 220.5 than Adolis for 110.
Yeah, I think that's fair. I with each passing day, I'm more interested in Justin Crawford, truly, who they are just all in on. I mean, I don't have another way to say it. I saw a clip of Rob Thompson being asked about just the Phillies offseason. This is before Bader. And he was like, yeah, after we signed Adolis, I called Justin Crawford. And I was like, don't worry, man. Like, you're gonna play. I'm like, this dude hasn't even debuted yet. And we're making sure he knows that his spot's not being taken by someone they're bringing in. And we'll talk more about Justin Crawford, the player, when we get there. He's a very interesting prospect. But it is just a lot of faith in him, and clearly also a lot of faith in Adolis to bounce back from what has been two atrocious seasons. I will say it would not shock me if Adolis Garcia has a better offensive season than Harrison Bader this year. It would not shock me. And Adolis Garcia has shown to be capable of being a plus right fielder. It's different than being a good center fielder. There are other roster configurations that should be probably considered when comparing the two. But now, indisputably, we will be comparing the two, which is a very strange comparison I wasn't expected to be making at any point. But that's what the Phillies do. Yeah. Think about how quickly the Phillies jumped on Adolis also, right? I think at the time it was like, well, we better get on this soon. Now it's like, did you? Because Bader felt like a good fit, but maybe they just didn't want to give him 2 years. All right, Jake, let's take a break. When we return, we're going to take a look. The MLB Network Top 100 list. 100 baseball players. That's a lot of players. We'll be right back.
And welcome back to the end of Baseball Barbacast. As is the case every year, MLB Network came out with its list of the top 100 players in baseball. And that is exactly the type of uranium-laced fuel that I need for a nuclear overreaction. That's kind of the whole point of ranking things, Jordan. You rank things so that people can disagree with the way you rank things. And that is where debate lies. Now, then you can do a million different, you can start a million different places here, right? Like, you rank 100 players. There's no perfect order. How you folded pitchers is impossible. Is there anything in here, okay, that makes you mad? That you see and you're like, that is disrespectful. These people should be fired.
Mm-hmm. So I do think that, right, there's a couple categories. There's basically who didn't make the list. And we have a very clear number one of who didn't make the list that everyone's losing their mind over. That's Nico Horner. And I agree. I would probably have Nico Horner somewhere in the 50s or 60s, and he's not even on here. So that's a simple one. Am I mad? No, I'm not. I'm not that angry of a person. And like Andrés Muñoz, right? But I struggle with comparing hitters or pitchers has always been hard for me in stuff like this, and why in general when we talk about them in like MVP, I don't even really know how to talk about them. But in this case, you really do have some interesting. It's just not apples to apples. When we're talking about value, when we're talking about who would I rather have on my team, I'm just taking the hitter so much more often. And yet there are some pitchers I'm like, how are they that low? So right. I go back and forth, which is a pretty bad answer. So, are there any others like, how is that guy ahead of that guy? Especially when they're in close proximity because you're looking at them.
Sure. There's one that's not on here that like does actually make me mad, and that's Dalton Varsho. Who?
Okay, more than Horner.
As much as Horner?
Really? I mean, to me, that's a similar conversation.
Now, they're very similar players. The difference is that Varsho missed half of the season with an injury, but he took like such an interesting offensive step forward where the impact with the bat, to me, is like compelling. Where with Horner, like obviously a really good player, his offensive game feels a little bit more volatile because it's just built around average so much more?
I mean, I disagree with that. When I mean, I don't. Horner has been basically the same guy for the last 4 years. He is obviously the best, arguably the best, or one of the best second basemen in the sport defensively. My beef with Varsho, yes, the fact that he missed time and still hit 20 homers is impressive. It's 284 on base. And I think that if you gave him 500 plate appearances, I don't much as know. It's similar because they're both elite defensively and have interesting offensive cases. So I think that's fine. And I think them over more like well-rounded but more boring cases like a Brendan Donovan, like an Isak Paredes is interesting. But I hear you. So in both terms of these not, guys, anyone else not on the list? Yeah.
Well, I like for Horner to be left out and Altuve to be on here is hilarious and like just a career achievement award for Altuve. Now it's not the best players of last season, right? Like it's the best players entering the next season. And I think that is why Altuve is definitely too high is like you project forward. Other dudes, one other thing about this list, the bottom like 20 guys are clearly like, oh, we got some teams that don't have any players on here. Like we got, we got to get our White Sox. We got to get our Rocky on here. We got to get a Cardinal on here.
Yeah. Yeah. That's accurate. I don't think. I mean, which is fine. You can imagine if you're MLB Network, that is a reasonable take to make. I'm interested in some of the guys that moved down. I mean, there's obvious ones that just had huge seasons that take huge jumps up, right? Like Cal Raleigh. We can talk about where he places exactly, but there's no surprise that someone having a historic season is going to jump up the way that he did. Yamamoto, same thing. Schwarber, I would say same thing. Although, Crochet. As I said when we talked about him with MVP, like was he that different than his previous seasons? I don't really think so, but sure. Any other just like huge jumps up? To me, it's the ones that fall down for reasons I'm not totally. Like, this feels like some pretty serious Gunnar Henderson disrespect falling from 10 to 26 and below Geraldo Perdomo, who I love. But that one is a bit of a maybe too much of an overcorrection to me, I would say.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know if there's any others that fell off, but Rafi maybe more Devers. Than they deserved.
Rafael Devers dropping 25 Devers? Spots.
Yeah. Why?
Jackson Churio dropping 16 spots. Duran and Merrill dropping big. That makes sense to me. I would say
Devers. Devers is a really funny one. He had the same. You could argue he had a better season offensively.
Maybe they dropped him because he's selfish and he wanted out of town.
I mean, and he struck out more, but other than that, I don't understand that drop at all. I mean, Devers freaking raked.
Brent Rooker dropped like 50 spots. I guess his season was half as good. Sure. He was merely good instead of incredible. Top. Let's talk about the top 10, because I think that is the most interesting. These are the biggest players in the sport in the world. I have no issue with the top three. I think Ohtani, Judge, Bobby Witt Jr. is the correct order for where our game's at right now.
No notes.
There's a Judge over Ohtani argument. Well, I disagree with it. Yeah. I don't think there's a Witt over Judge argument or a Witt over Ohtani argument. I think these are the three best players in the sport, and this is the correct order. I think the next three players on this list, which are Cal Raleigh, Jose Ramirez, and Juan Soto, are the correct next three players, but I don't agree with the order. I would do Ramirez, Soto, Raleigh. I know that Cal Raleigh was a good player before this season. He has been an elite, elite player for 162 games. And I would just take guys like Ramirez and Soto over that package.
Totally valid. I think this is also where Skeens over Skubal is certainly debatable, although I guess if we're thinking about going forward, how much better is Tarek Skubal going to get versus how much better is Paul Skeens going to get? I don't know. But I think
I don't think Paul Skeens... You think Paul Skeens is going to get better? He's going to get better? Jordan. He had a 197.
I know that. But why are we saying Paul Skeens can't do something? I just think what I was going to bring up, regardless of whether you go Skeens, Skubal, Skeens, to me, I could also see an argument for having them be 4 and 5.
Sure.
Because they do feel like they've elevated above the other pitchers. Maybe that's Garrett Crochet disrespect, Yamamoto disrespect, fine. But I don't know. Like, it does feel a little weird to see them. Although, honestly, the more I look at this now, I think I actually do like where they are. I think that
I would take Skubal over Skeens
below them. Okay, yeah,
I would take Skubal over Skeens for one reason, and that is that Skubal throws with his left arm and Skeens throws with his right arm. That is literally the only difference,
in my mind
right now. I think the rest of this top 10 is fine with Carroll at 9 and Guerrero at 10. Who from outside the top 10 would you put into the top 10? I think there's a Crochet argument for sure. Mm-hmm. And I think there is a Julio Rodriguez argument.
I think Julio is the most likely to be on the top 10 next year. Sure. I don't think that he's necessarily earned it so far because he's still basically just done the same thing every year where he's bad for 2 months and then amazing for the rest of the season. I think that Acuña, Tatis, and Julio are all very tough to talk about. Lindor is an interesting one too. He kind of gets lost in the shuffle. Obviously, a year ago, we were talking about him in this MVP case. And I think also when we talk about all-around production, and part of why I think Bobby Witt is so clearly the best or the third best player is not just the offense, but the fact that he's become elite defensive shortstop, which was not always the case early in his career. Lindor still has that for him going also. So I don't want to discount that if we're just going like best baseball player. I think you could even argue Lindor belongs over Carroll and Guerrero for that reason. I wouldn't because I think the offense at this point is a tick below those two guys. But I think you could still make that case because of how good he is still a shortstop.
Kyle Tucker at 21, which kind of proves our point when we were talking about his signing. Like, should the 21st best player in the world be, you know, the highest paid player in the world ever? Certainly weird to see him here. Mookie is too high on this list, I think. Amazing as he is, and his move to shortstop was incredible. The offensive profile makes me concerned. I put all of the position players, Jordan, on a like X, Y axis, like rank and B war, which is very, very crude way to do this. You know the lowest B war is on this list?
I assume it's some DH or someone that was injured.
Both of those things are true. Mike Trout. Mike Trout, ranked 82 on this list, is the lowest value wins above replacement player included on the top 100.
That's so bleak. Trout was so much worse, and yet
pretty good.
86th percentile ex-WOBA, 93rd percentile barrel rate, 100th percentile launch angle sweet spot. He's so much worse and still pretty good. But if he's not playing the field, yeah, that's going to hurt in the old war department. So anyone, I'm trying to think if there's any other ones that like super jump out. And then, yeah, it's like, why are some relievers on here and others aren't? I don't know. How many relievers are on here? Mason Miller.
Three.
I think Chapman. And
Eddie
that D. It? And Edwin Diaz, of course. So I'm not sure why Mason Miller is that far ahead of those other guys. I don't know, but I would probably be too Vinny scared Pasquantino, to rank literally any reliever.
Vinny Pasquantino, congratulations, friend of the program, making it in at 93. Hell yeah, dude. Love that for him.
If you could pick one player, let's finish on this. Pick one player outside the top 20 to finish inside the top 10. Actually, that's too easy because it's Gunnar Henderson. Outside the top 30 to finish inside the top 10 this time a year ago. Who you got?
For next, like for when we do this a year from now, you mean?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's pretty clearly two answers. I think
Cam and Arrow.
Yeah.
Is an answer. I don't think PCA will like do first half PCA again, but he's definitely an answer. I think Roman Anthony is an answer. And then the one that kind of comes to mind at 32 is Bryce Harper. Like if Bryce Harper is insulted, like this is how this could play out, right? Bryce Harper insulted by Dave Dombrowski saying that he's not elite anymore, you know, spinning his blood in a machine and lying under, you know, red light blankets and whatnot. Like, I could see a Bryce Harper sixth place MVP finish. You know what I mean? That is the other one, I think, on this list.
Yeah. Here's another way to think about it. It's like, how many spots in the top 10 are even plausibly going to be available? Because to me, it's really five at the most, right? I think Cal regressing and being merely awesome and not historic probably takes him out of the top 10. I think even unless Jose Ramirez slipping a little bit, he's probably 10 to 15. And then
Ohtani, Judge, and Witt aren't going anywhere. Soto's not going anywhere.
And I don't think Ski and Scoobal are either if they're healthy.
Unless there's an injury. Like, that's the only way. And so it's hard to see people jumping into that top 10. But I mean, like, look, like when you look at last year's rank, you know, it was like a good way to think about this, where it's like, okay, so then like, who was in the top 10 last year? We were like, oh, that's inconceivable, right? Like, Jordan at 7 last year, we were probably like, oh, there's no way he moves. And, you know, he drops down. Like, this happens every year. Guys jump and guys fall. And yeah.
Yeah, I think we mentioned, I don't know if you said, but Roman Anthony, I would think you'd have to put at least in this bucket because players that are that young that we're projecting forward, and if they're that good that quickly, like, why can't he just have a Corbin Carroll type season, you know, maybe not as much on the speed side of things. And then, you know, Ellie, still going to put Ellie in there. So we will see if he can do it. And James Wood. James Wood could just hit 50 homers.
I really love
talking about him.
The stretch of players in the 30s, which is just from 31 to 38 is all vets. Matt Olson, Bryce Harper, Pete Alonso, Manny Machado, Alex Bregman, Max Fried, Logan Webb, Chris Sale, and then Junior Caminero at 39. That's very fun. I'm excited for the release of the Foolish 50, our friend Foolish Baseball. He ranks his top 50 players every year. Excited to see when that comes out. Jordan, that is the podcast. That's all I got today. Thank you all for listening. The world is a dark and dreary place. We are thankful that we can hop on here and, you know, provide a distraction. Or I'm just feeling down, man. I'm feeling down right now. I don't know.
Not at least fun we got ball in the world. Not a fun weekend in the world. But we're doing our best. We're human like everybody else, but we appreciate everyone that listens and supports us, and we hope everyone is taking care of each other to the best of their ability. Thank you to Andrew Hartz. Thank you to Ingrid Rosas for producing. And we will be back later this week. Who knows what we'll be talking about? Goodbye.